Today we have a very interesting and broad subject, which is really almost the totality of British foreign policy, if I could summarise it that way. I remember reading the book that we are talking about today, The Investing for Influence, which came out from the LSE Diplomacy Commission. One of the phrases it uses, it says, rather provocatively, but in my view, probably rightly, today Britain is increasingly insular and self-absorbed. An uncertain internationalist, sidelined in Syria, ineffective in Ukraine, unwilling in Europe, inimical on refugees, a crisis of confidence has become a crisis of identity. That's quite a good point to start our debate here today. And we have two eminent speakers, both of whom were involved in the formulation of this report. I'll take them in the order that they need to speak, and I'll introduce them now, so as to avoid it later. Dr. Nicholas Kitchen is Assistant Professorial Research Fellow in the United States Centre for the London School of Economics, and he was Executive Director of the LSE Diplomacy Commission, which published this particular report. Professor Michael Cox is Director of the LSE Ideas and Emeritus Professor at the International Relations Department of the LSE, and he also was involved in the formulation of this report. I'm going to ask Nicholas Kitchen to speak first, and after that Michael Cox, and then at about 1:30 I will open it to the floor for questions, comments, and so on.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Michael, for that introduction and for inviting us to come speak here today. I'm just going to run you through a little bit about what's in the report here and why we undertook this project. It was about late 2013, I think, that we started to think about this issue and convened the Diplomacy Commission of the LSE, and I should say a thank you to our funders, the LSE's Higher Education Innovation Fund. Well done to Hefke for giving us that money. And we were picking up from a number of people that we were working with in ideas who have been involved in government, a sense of disquiet about the direction of British foreign policy. Not just the cuts to the FCO, now more or less forestalled. We won't claim credit for that. This report came out a little bit late. But something more fundamental in terms of strategy and purpose of British foreign policy. And so we wanted to look at that and investigate that. And second, we had a sense that successive governments had been conducting strategy reviews, SDSRs, NSSs, etc. But these were kind of limited by the fact that they took place within government and were necessarily an exercise in negotiation between competing vested interests and started from a particular position. So what we wanted to do was to start with more of a blank sheet of paper. And we convened a set of people who you'll find in the first couple of pages of the report, from academia, previously from government, from civil society, from journalism, from business. And then we conducted hearings where we met with a load of people and interviewed a load of people from those kinds of sectors. And the whole idea was that we wanted this set of experienced and smart and expert people to conduct, I guess, the strategic equivalent of zero-based budgeting. We interrogate foundational assumptions anew. We go in, everything that we think we know, we ask again. And so that was the process that we went through, and that's kind of reflected in the structure of the report. So we begin by asking a very basic question about how the world works. We don't assume who the relevant actors are. So we ask those questions. We then think about what are Britain's particular interests and assets in that world. And then we think about, given those things, what might be a strategic purpose for the UK and the balance of means necessary to achieve that. And I guess one of the conclusions that comes out of the report, looking at it like that and doing strategies like that, is to say that the kind of mandatory GDP based targets for funding of particular departments. I think we use the phrase economically and strategically incoherent, you know, because we're building strategy on first principles. So you don't build it by saying we're going to have 0.7% of GDP for development, because it doesn't make sense. We're starting from first principles. I think the nature of these kinds of exercises and the diversity of the people we had on the commission means that it's probably not the most specific document in the world. You know, it's one of those things where you've got to get everyone on board with it. So you won't find strong policy statements on specific issues in here. And it's not intended in that sense to be a blueprint for policy. What we really hope this can be is the beginnings of a debate about British foreign policy, one in particular that goes beyond Whitehall, you know, where we're sat here today, and goes further out into the country. Now, I'm not going to take it through the report in terms of its sections. You can all have a look at it yourself. But I do want to highlight a couple of the challenges that flow from the analysis that I think we identify, and a couple of the opportunities that I think comes from what we're talking about. The first challenge is a challenge for states, and this flows from our analysis of kind of what the world we live in looks like. We talk about it being marked by globalization and diffusion, but we think that this is significant, that this makes the 21st century international system qualitatively different from the international system of the 19th and 20th centuries. States are important, and the state system is embedded. States are perhaps more territorially secure than they've ever been. But in some sense, states are less powerful. They've lost control over the means and modes of production. They've lost control, willingly, in many cases, over the operation of markets. They've lost control over the provision of information. And in many ways, they've lost control over the means of violence. If you think, you know, an IED is $200, right? Very easily put together and very easily delivered. States have lost, in some sense, legitimacy as actors. We have a population in the world that's more educated than ever before. It has more access to freer media and consumes vastly more media than ever before. And all that creates a set of populations who are more critical and less deferent to established authorities, be they corporations as well as institutions, and particularly institutions like states. There's a particular statistic about in the United States, where they've been asking people since the 1960s, do you trust your government to do the right thing most of the time? And that level is around about sort of 60, 70% when they first start asking this question. I think it's the late 1950s. It tanks after Vietnam and Watergate. Okay, it's down to sort of 20%. But it never rises back above 25 to 30% again, which means for the past 40, anyone under the age of 40 in the United States has lived their entire life in a country where the majority of people don't trust their government to do the right thing most of the time. And that strikes me as pretty significant for thinking about what the government can do in those people's name. And I think, thirdly, the disappearance of great power war is a serious policy option for states. Limits what states can do. Now, this is not to say that great power war is obsolete or impossible, but that it is in ways that it perhaps wasn't in the 19th century, particularly in the 20th century. I think the phrase I would use on this is, it is seriously and obviously stupid. And as a result, that has implications for the use of coercive tools further down the ladder of escalation. It becomes more difficult for states to use these as policy options. Now, this challenge, taken together, we have a sense that this remakes the international system and the rules and the modes of power within it. That it undermines compelling strategies, and creates a corollary increase in a demand that compliance be cultivated, utilising persuasion and influence. Now, specifically within that context, it's important for the UK, as part of a Western core, to understand that Western core is shrinking. Now, I think Mick will probably push back on some of the power shifts narrative, and I think he's right to do so. But even as GDP is a notoriously poor indicator for all sorts of things, if we do want to think about where stuff happens in the world, and I think I can probably stretch GDP to give me an indication of that, EU plus US plus Japan has declined from 72% of global GDP in 1992 to 52%. So that's a fairly significant, and most of that has gone obviously to Asia, but that's a fairly significant decline in the sense that Western core of states being the place where things happen. So that's a challenge for states and particularly for Western states. Second challenge, can there be a unified British national interest? The Commission were fairly sceptical of that. Why? Because of the type of the country that the UK is today. We can talk about the breakup of the Union, but I think more important than that is the breaking down of national boundaries and national consciousness in many ways, and if in the UK this is particularly acute. We are home to the most diverse immigrant population in the world. Of the UK's population of 64 million people, nearly 8 million were born elsewhere. There are populations of over 20,000 people from 60 different countries, some of which 40 of which are outside of Europe. This is a society where people have radically different perceptions of what their interests are as British citizens. And I think those experiences and those perceptions are very different from the people who have traditionally made British foreign policy. Wise, nearly always white, nearly always men, whose experiences and readings of history have been passed through institutions like the FCO, and which perhaps British foreign policy needs to look at afresh and bring some new perspectives to. And you see this in some of the UK strategic documents. They admit this diversity and then attempt to externalise it, to treat it as a problem. So we make ourselves, there's some kind of idea of a stable national subject. I'm not sure who that's supposed to be, but we have to secure that national subject against the risks that are inherent from this kind of globally connected population that we have. I know we don't seek to, I think, downplay those very real risks in the report. We do emphasise the issues of terrorism, cyber attacks, migration. I think they're risks which require strategies of management that increase society's resilience rather than us thinking of those as threats to be met and eradicated. That, I think, brings me on to the first opportunity, which is created by this very population, this very diversity, which generates connectedness to all sorts of other parts of the world. And the UK is a serious international actor. I think there's a huge amount of decline narrative in British foreign policy debates, whether we're talking about the UK can be a bridge or a global hub. I think it was Miliband's thing back in 2008. And, of course, we have a whole section on this, the perpetual phrase of British foreign policy that we must punch above our weight. I cannot describe to you quite the level of vitriol reserved for this phrase that the commissioners, I think, shared. So there's a whole section of the report committed to debunking this. First of all, we think punching above your weight is a pretty stupid thing to do, just on its own terms. But secondly, we think Britain's actually, pretty weighty as a country. And a lot of that derives from Britain's network connectedness. A global network that operates at levels from embassies. We have the second most embassies of any country in the world. To small businesses, individuals. We're second only to France in terms of membership of international institutions. We are, for now, a major economy in the world's largest single market. We are a major military spender and part of the world's largest security organization. We are unique in the links that we have to the Commonwealth, and you can go on. You know, we publish more books per capita than any country in the world. It would be remiss of me to come from the LSE and not mention that, you know, 12% of the world's scientific papers are produced in the UK, and you know, the second best university system in the world, and the world's greatest soft power actor, according to Facebook, of all places. And we think that this this sense of Britain's weight and its connectedness creates real opportunities for crafting a role as a convener, a gender setter, a coalition builder across a whole range of global challenges. Michael read out the sort of first headline line of the report, and almost to do this kind of role, to be a convener, you don't even need to take positions as such. Right? You know, if we are still being reticent, all you have to do is to highlight issues that are important, bring others together with the expertise and creativity to try and address them. There's one caution here, I think, is that this what we call hyper-connectedness in the report is not a given. It can be eroded by parochialism, by too narrow a focus on limited interests. I think quite a lot of pushback against the commercialization of British diplomacy in the last few years. But if cultivated and harnessed, connectedness can be a foundation for kind of confident internationalism. And second opportunity, and just to finish up, is actually our diplomats. And repeatedly throughout the process of doing this report, the Commission came back to this is about diplomacy. We need to think about diplomats and the people that they are and the qualities that they have. And we heard repeatedly how well thought of British diplomats tend to be. Intelligent, skilled, able to generate ideas and engage a whole spectrum of state, private and civil society actors. And our analysis of the world in that first section, and the overriding importance of exercising influence, suggests to us that those countries that have highly skilled diplomatic services will do well. But we also heard repeatedly how diplomats' ability to perform those functions has been progressively eroded through resource cuts from across the range, from language training to even the standard of accommodation. You can't entertain fellow diplomats because you're in a one-bed flat with no dining room space, right? You know, these ground-level concerns. So, I mean, the key recommendation of the report, at least in my mind, is that the diplomatic service needs to be better supported and renewed. That we need people within that diplomatic service that better reflect the society that they represent. And the FCO has done okay in recruitment terms in improving the representation of women and ethnic minorities within its staff, but rather less well, particularly in diversifying the socioeconomic backgrounds of those people. And one thing we call very strongly for is the need for those people to be supported throughout their careers, living and working overseas, through regular moves. We need to think about matching careers for partners. We need to think how to best support children's education for diplomats. We need to think about not just the diplomats' immediate family, but the care requirements they may have for extended family and how we can cycle them back through the UK more often, you know, when they have those kinds of challenges to deal with. So to conclude, this is an optimistic report. I think some might argue too optimistic. But that optimism is grounded in a requirement for a concerted effort from people who think and talk about foreign policy to think beyond the challenges of the day-to-day that often appear so intractable and oppressive, and engage in a debate about foreign policy that hopefully goes beyond Whitehall and beyond Newsnight and perhaps reaches out to communities in Rochdale on BBC Three. And so we hope that this commission will act as a kickstarter to that, and we can have some of those conversations in the Q&A. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Nick rather surprised me then by saying he thought it was an optimistic report. I
kind of read it rather differently, and I think Michael's earlier comment kind of threw that one out. But I mean, you know, to start with the obvious thing, obviously there are a lot of criticisms contained in the report, but one needs to balance that against the obvious things which Britain does right. The economy is big, London is attractive, it's politically stable, the British are still, I think, regarded as being people who do fair play. We've got the Parliament, which isn't too bad. We've got strong public servants, we've got military capabilities, we're members of the UN, and above everything else, we have great universities, of which I am a member of one. In a funny sort of way, I think one of the great strengths of this country is we do soft power without thinking about it. I think when states and countries have to consciously do soft power, that means they don't get it. This, in some ways, without being insulting to anybody from the People's Republic of China, if you do official soft power, you're not getting soft power. Soft power happens. It's not something you plan, organise through a government department. So in many ways, there is an optimism within the report. We recognise some of the obvious strengths in this country. I think we've even got out of empire pretty well. I'm constantly told I'm a kind of post-colonial who hasn't quite got over losing India. Well, I got over losing India a long time ago when the Indian cricket team started beating England rather easily, you know. So I think there's lots of things that Britain has got over rather well, and many things that it's adapted to rather rapidly, and actually in some senses much more successfully than some of our European partners. So that's the good news. That's the good news. Let me just take my own personal take on it and just try and draw out a few points that I want to draw out. There's some of which are contained in the Investing for Influence, but we're not a party school. This is not a party document. We're not under democratic centralism, and therefore we don't necessarily have to all sing from the same hymn sheet. I think, broadly speaking, I agree with the bulk of this. I'm bound to, because Nick was my PhD student, and I've been working with him at LSE for a long time. But let me just pick up on three big questions and maybe run those past you, much of which is already implied in the report itself. First question, which is dealt with in the report, maybe the big question and the biggest question of all, notwithstanding terrorism and all the issues that that raises, but looking in the broader tectonic plate problem. We have, it has been said, been living since Jim O'Neill wrote a pamphlet in 2001. We've been living in the era of power shift. Jim O'Neill invented it for Goldman Sachs, if you remember, back in November 2001. He identified four countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. It was the beginning of a new narrative, which took off throughout from 2001, 2003, right until 2 or 3 years ago. I think the wind has gone out of that particular argument. But then book after book after book, op-ed after op-ed was written about how the world was shifting, changing, and going somewhere else from where it had once been. Where it had once been, according to my good colleague at the LSE, Danny Kwa, the centre of economic world was halfway across the Atlantic, between Europe and the United States. It has shifted, according to Danny, 9,500 kilometres eastwards, and is now somewhere along the Silk Road, halfway between New Delhi and China. Other books have been written, of course, many of them bad, some of them good, on China, most of them rather poor, I think, and some with rather dramatic titles, such as When China Rules the World. Not if, but when. I think now the author of that has actually said he really wishes he hadn't used that title, but it did help sell 100,000 copies. And then, if you don't want that power shift to the BRICS or to China, you can have the rest. That's a rather vague notion, but Fareed Zakaria, whom we all listen to occasionally and sometimes read, Fareed said, it's not the rise of one country, it's the rise of the rest, whoever the rest are. Seems everybody else except the Europeans and the Americans. Or you could have Asia. And of course, there's been a large amount of stuff written about, the whole problem about the new Asian century. There's a whole kind of literature now on this. Now, what I want to say is not to dispute obvious economic facts. I mean, you know, GDP has shifted, world trade has shifted, there's been obvious changes. Who can deny the importance of China? It would be kind of madness for anybody to deny it. But I want to kind of raise two questions about this whole debate about power shift, as it's been understood, and what policies have derived from it in this country. And I think we've had a problem dealing with this, actually. And I don't think it's about us losing influence or power in the simple sense of the old 19th century rise of Germany means a diminution of British power. I don't think we're in the 19th century. Nick is absolutely right. It ain't like that. But I think we've had two real problems with this whole debate, I think. And I think it has influenced discussions in this country quite a lot. Firstly, I don't think we've worked out actually how to orient towards it very successfully. And I think we saw this, if I might be blunt, and I'm not a diplomat, I work at the LSE, so basically I can say what I like as long as I don't criticise the boss. I don't think we really understood quite how to orient towards China. I think I detected quite a lot of misgivings, worries, concerns about how we have addressed China over the last year. Not because we should not have proper relations with China, that goes without saying. Not that we shouldn't have economic or diplomatic relations with China. But simply the way that this was portrayed and understood, particularly after the visit, during the visit of the President here. And I have attended seminar after seminar at the LSE on this question, and it doesn't mean to say therefore it's true because it's at the LSE, but I think that reflects a wider debate, which kind of asks some bigger questions. Are we asking tough questions about that relationship? Are we asking the kind of questions that some are asking elsewhere in the world, as in Australia, or as in the United States, about how we should relate economically with all the implications of what that may mean, say, for Chinese control of certain infrastructural projects within this country? Is it that our foreign policy, to put it rather bluntly, has become economistic? And we, you know, I'm not saying anything of any great originality to suggest to you that the term "it's a treasury-driven foreign policy" was repeated so frequently by nearly every single newspaper in this country before, during, and after the visit that it did raise a question. And I've spoken to a number of people in the FCO who raised the same question. They felt fairly sidelined. So it does raise that question of how we are addressing ourselves as an individual country, the rise of China, and how are we dealing with that emergence? And whether we're having a balanced policy towards China, whether it is China is actually driving much of what we're having to do rather than us setting our own agenda. We had a very interesting visit at the school the other night. I chaired, very privileged to chair, our wonderful ambassador in Beijing at the moment, Barbara Woodward. She's fantastic, first woman ambassador there. And this was a question that came up to her time and time and time again. And the fact that people are asking that question tells you something, that people are worried about it. So that's the first question I want to raise about the power shift, how we ourselves as a country are relating to the rise of China, whether we're doing it in a balanced fashion. The second thing, of course, is that if we think of the rise of certain parts of the world, we think of decline of other parts of the world. There's nothing historians love better than rise and decline of empires. After all, the British establishment, some part in this building, were brought up on thinking about the rise and decline of the Roman Empire, worrying, of course, that if they could learn the lessons of the decline of the Roman, the British Empire may last a couple of centuries longer. A perfectly reasonable thing to do. But we love rise and decline. And I think the rise and decline narrative we've been having over the last year or two, or maybe a few years, has led us to think, I believe, in this country, maybe elsewhere, that other parts of the world are rising, but there's one part of the world which is in irreversible decline. And that's Europe. I think that a narrative has crept into the debate about Europe. And I think it's influenced certainly the current discussion. And you hear it. You do hear it. I'm not going to take sides in the Brexit debate just yet. We do that in Q&A. But it's crept into the discussion that somehow or another Asia and somewhere else represents the economic future, and that kind of quagmire across La Manche, which we for the moment call Europe, is somehow on the way down. And I think, again, that is influenced and shaping part of our current debate about where we should or should not be. I think part of that analysis has real problems, I'll be perfectly honest with you. So that's the first point I want to raise, Michael, on the whole question of how we think about power shifting and how we've oriented towards it, either in the case of China or in terms of our analysis of European decline over the long term. I think there's a problem in both, to be perfectly honest. The second thing I want to raise, and we touch on it in the pamphlet here, in our book, and I would, maybe I should have said more about this in there, but I'll bring it up now anyway for Q&A reasons, is we're so busy looking for change in the world, which is perfectly reasonable. You don't want to be left behind. You know, otherwise, you know, you just look like some old fella who kind of can't keep up, who can't use email or something. But we're so busy looking for change in the world that actually we forget something about what hasn't. Now, it's not about states. I think Nick is quite right to, you know, raise the question about our states still. They're still the fundamental unit of international relations, but much more happens outside of states, besides states, and all the rest. I accept change. But I wonder, in the process of kind of looking for the change in the world, technologies, power shifts and all the rest of it, whether we've neglected the notion of having traditional allies. Now, this may sound rather a remarkable thing to say, but I kind of look in the language sometimes. We don't seem to have allies any longer. We have partners. We've got partners everywhere. Well, maybe I was brought up on the Cold War. Maybe I'm kind of a throwback to a moment in time of only 40 years when we had a divided Europe and Germany and we had East versus West and all the rest of it. But I kind of raised this question quite deliberately because the more I travel around the world, and I do a lot of it, the more I go to other countries, which I'm bound to do, teaching international relations is a very good thing to do. What I find is that when you go to a Washington or when you go to a Beijing or when you go to some European capitals, there is a sense that the perceptions of Britain are going down. I can't see any way around that at the moment. Look very recently at the comments made by President Obama in that article following the... Now, that is not the standard American presidential way of perceiving Britain. And we know President Obama is going to be coming to this country very soon to make a very strong argument yet again for the UK to stay inside the European Union. If you speak to Chinese officials, which I do a lot, they may have certain different views about the future of Britain in the European Union, but my overall interpretation of what I hear from Chinese officials when I go to Beijing and elsewhere, they can't really understand why this is actually happening. You know, it's kind of, you know, and if Britain were to decide to make a decision in a certain way in June, then this would diminish Britain's position and its relevance. Well, not entirely, but certainly diminish its view. And I think the same is equally true in main European capitals. In other words, I wonder, we've been so engaged with thinking about what's changing in the world, we maybe need to think a lot more about, are we neglecting our traditional relationships, particularly transatlantic? I don't think it's about to fall down. It's not about to break up. I don't use the word special relationship all the time. But nonetheless, I think there are some real issues there, and we can see them. We don't even have to listen to Mr. Trump, who wants to abolish NATO now. I hear that's a new innovative strategic thinking on his part. The third point I want to raise, other than the two I have, by way of opening it up for a little bit of contretemps and engagement with the audience, Michael, is it is impossible now, it seems to me, to neglect a gap. And the gap is increasingly, and Nick, you touched on this, on the whole issue of trust. There's an increasing gap, it seems to me, in many countries in the world, maybe less so in China, maybe less so in Russia, I don't know. I don't know enough about either to know about public opinion in Russia or China. But I think in the West, and certainly in the United States, I think there's a growing gap between what ordinary people on the ground are thinking and understanding and what elites are thinking and doing and understanding. I think Trumpism, and I'll call Trump an ism now, and I'll end in a moment. I think Trumpism is a manifestation of that. The enormous support, by the way, that our socialist senator has also got in the US tells us something. I think Brexitism, if I can use it as an ism for the moment, is also an illustration of a growing gap between the perceptions and feelings of ordinary people in the street and elites. We can call it populism, we may decry it, we may like to use the word, they're losers, these people are, you know, not informed enough. But there is, it seems to me, a huge and growing gap between what a lot of ordinary people in streets and in pubs around this country and other countries are thinking and feeling, as in the United States, as in Europe. And if and until that gap is closed, I think it's going to be hugely difficult in this country as elsewhere to evolve a stable foreign policy for the long term. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.